Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life, the trials, the tribulations, and the triumphs. Discussions about how faith matters to you and our community. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, whose mission is to extend Christian ministry by caring for the whole person, body, mind, and spirit, and by working with others to improve health and quality of life in our communities. Now, here's your host, Ted Dodds.
Hello, I'm Ted Dodds, and welcome to Faith Matters. Today, our guest is Dr. Lisa Viator, who is the Associate Director of the Student Counseling Center at Texas Tech University. Lisa, I am so delighted you're here.
Thank you
for coming to be with us. Now, if you don't mind, I'd give a word of introduction. I only know you kind of from a distance. The distance is, number one, I've watched you as you parented from a distance, and I've been very impressed with the children you have raised and seen into life and now adulthood. I have known about your work at the counseling center, but nothing very directly. I've also seen you function in a church setting and bring a lot of talent and commitment through a lot of years to that. So would you mind starting off by telling us where you came from and how you got to Lubbock and what Lubbock has done to you?
Done to or for? I've lived a lot of places, but I grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, lived there for 18 years, and then went off to college in Connecticut, and spent 4 years at Wesleyan in Connecticut. And then I went directly to graduate school in Nebraska, got my master's and PhD in clinical psychology at University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and did an internship for a year at University of Maine, and then got my first job as a psychologist at a student counseling center at the University of Kentucky. I spent 9 years in Kentucky, but I wasn't working that whole time. Once I started having kids, I quit that, did a little bit of private practice. Along the way, I met my husband, and we got married in, Kentucky, and then he got an offer he couldn't refuse from Texas Tech. So we moved out to Lubbock in 2000. I've seen a lot of change in Lubbock over the past 14 years.
Oh, well, my, you bring rich cultures to Lubbock. What kind of changes have you seen, Lisa?
Well, when I first came to Lubbock, what I noticed immediately was that everyone is very nice and very genial. People greet you in the grocery store, and that's not what I was used to, But I think there was also a certain solidness, I guess, in belief systems that were not easily challenged. There wasn't a whole lot of openness that I noticed in terms of differing views, that kind of thing. But I think what I've noticed is that while the niceness continues, I think I've seen a little bit more openness.
Do you have a way of it? To what do you attribute that if we are becoming more open in this culture?
I think that the times are changing, and while Lubbock is fairly isolated in the country, I think Lubbock is kind of slowly coming along as well, just in terms of maybe a bit more receptiveness, maybe to differences in sexual orientation and things like that.
Uh-huh. So in your work, say, with students, I would guess that their own openness is an important avenue to health. But now,
oh, absolutely.
Oh, is it? All right, good.
Yeah.
So say in students in this culture, if they tend to have grown up in a culture a little more isolated, mm-hmm. How does a psychologist working with them, if it's a road to health, to be open? How do you help them become more open?
It's never helpful to shove something down someone's throat. And if there's a weakness that I have as a psychologist, sometimes I've been accused of being a little pushy, so to speak. I think, hanging back and asking a lot of questions and suggesting different perspectives, whether it's how students view themselves or how they view their relationships or, how they view, culture in general, getting them to think, I think, is the very first step. And once they're thinking, then, things kind of develop from there.
Wow, what a great answer. I'm just a little amazed that you consider yourself pushy.
Well, you haven't seen me in group therapy.
Oh, all right. Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I see. So you use the hanging back and helping them to think as avenues to increasing openness.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of rigidity among counselees that you see that's prevalent or more common?
You know, I'm just thinking about one of the things that I specialize in is eating disorders. And a lot of times young women come in with a very rigid view of what they think they're supposed to look like, how much they're supposed to weigh, what clothes size they're supposed to wear. There's a lot of rigidity there. It's scary for them to change. You know, it's scary for them. They're, you know, afraid that if they become more flexible in their eating or in how they view food, you know, changing their mindset towards food, weight, and clothes sizes, they're afraid it'll get out of control.
You know, I'm rather old now, but I have a lot of years working with people, young women, but I've often observed they come in with this picture. They're supposed to be a certain size, look a certain way, even smell a certain way.
Yeah.
Which takes them far away from their own self-identity.
Yes, and absolutely.
That's hard. And if we use that self-identity in this culture, do you have some observations about what's most difficult for women? You mentioned things like dress size, and but do you have other ideas?
Well, yeah, I think you bring up a really important point. They lose their identity, and in some cases with these college-age students, they fail to kind of form an identity that's outside of what their body looks like. You know, I do a lot of talking with people about who they are as opposed to what they look like. And I really try to use the analogy of a house. Like, your body's a house where you live, you know, and what's the most important thing about the house? How neatly kept it is, you know, maintenance, that kind of thing? Or is it who lives in the house?
That's a great analogy. Does that convey? Do counselees pick up on that since you give them an analogy to measure with?
Yeah, you know, there are times that works. You know, I see the light bulb go on, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there are other times that it's like, well, yeah, it's easy for you to say, you know, sitting over there, but you're not me. So it takes time. It takes time to change minds.
So if I said the tendency in our culture is to raise young women to grow up, look pretty, get married, and have children, and that's a kind of limiting sort of identity, how would a psychologist like you respond to my thought there?
I would say that for some people, that's fine. You know, that's who they are. They want to be wives and moms, and that's great. You know, I don't want to impose my values on people necessarily, but I think for some, you know, they want more than that, and that's great too.
We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with Dr. Lisa Viator.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Ted Dotz. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating Covenant Heart and Vascular Institute. Since 1965, Covenant has brought together cardiac physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. More information is available on cardiac care at 866-4-COVENANT. Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Ted Dotz.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ted Dotz, and our guest today is Dr. Lisa Viator, who is a psychologist, the associate director of the Student Counseling Center at Texas Tech University. And Lisa, I should like to ask you this question. Let's suppose we had an 11-year-old granddaughter. Would you talk about what causes work upon such a child, a young woman, a little girl, 11 years old, in our culture, both in Lubbock and nationally?
There are a lot of different causes of eating disorders, and I'll talk about, you know, some of them, but one of them I really think has to do with our capitalistic society. One of the ways that people make money is to convince us that there is something wrong with us, okay? And to kind of feed those insecurities and to offer the solution. okay? So I think about the fashion industry. I think about the diet industry. I think about the plastic surgery industry. I think about, you know, the fitness industry, you know, gyms and such. A lot of times, and I'm not saying everybody, you know, but a lot of times advertisements really try to sell us the notion that you're not okay the way you are. Your body, there's something wrong with your body. Oh, how shameful. You know, you see magazines like Us Weekly, I think is the worst one, that say, you know, most embarrassing and horrifying beach bodies. You know, you don't want to look like that, do you? Those types of messages feed insecurities in young pre-adolescent and adolescent girls about, oh, I don't want to be embarrassed by my body. Those kids are really vulnerable to developing eating disorders because they think, well, if I weighed 5 pounds or 10 pounds or 20 pounds less, then people wouldn't bully me, or I'd have a boyfriend or girlfriend, or, you know, I would generally feel more confident, you know, those kinds of things. But what people discover is that even after they lose 5 or 10 pounds, they, you know, those problems are still there. And even though they might get a lot of compliments right at first, oh, you look great, how'd you do that? They may still, you know, kind of suffer from some of the problems that, you know, they've scapegoated their body about.
Lisa, that's grand. Now, you parented young women, and so you knew the pressures that were upon them. As a parent, what did you attempt to bring to your children as they grew up, knowing these kinds of pressures were upon them?
You know, kind of going back to identity, I really tried to express my appreciation and my wonder for who they are and who they're becoming inside, rather than what they look like. So I would appreciate things about their creativity or about their ability to withstand pressure or their ability to learn things quickly. And so I would really emphasize those things. And I would kind of steer away from giving messages like, oh, don't eat that, that's a bad food. I really tried to kind of emphasize the idea that if you eat a lot of things, a lot of different kinds of things in moderation, and exercise in moderation, eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, you know, you're going to be the weight that you're supposed to be. Now, whether that conforms to what, you know, People Magazine thinks, you know, I don't know.
You used a word that really strikes me. You used the word wonder. You helped mm-hmm. your children by expressing a sense of wonder at mm-hmm. some unique aspect or mm-hmm. something that presented itself. But now I'm thinking, suppose when your children were in the teenage level and mm-hmm. they had all this pressure from their peers, how did you work with that pressure?
You know, my kids right now are 19, and then I have twins who are 17. And I've never really heard them talk a lot about feeling pressured to look a certain way. One of my kids is an athlete, and she's probably the heaviest of the three of them. She talks about, sometimes she'll talk about, oh, I'm the fattest one in our family. I'm like, you're not fat, that's muscle. And she's like, yeah, I know. And so she'll use fat and weight kind of interchangeably in a way that I try to steer her away from. But, you know, I do think she feels, she kind of falls into that way of speaking and thinking about her weight. You know, aside from that, I don't think any of my kids have gone on any major diets to lose weight or anything like that. You know, if anything, they do eat pretty well. The athlete child of mine, when she's in training, will stay away from the junk food at the advice of her coach. But I don't hear her saying, oh, I have to lose weight.
I liked what you said when she said something about herself that wasn't true. You said, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So what place does confrontation have in your life as a psychologist in addition to being a mother?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think I'm a different kind of therapist in the group therapy setting than I am individually, and I'm still trying to explore why that is. In individual therapy, I think my mindset is more toward, okay, my job is to understand what it feels like to walk around in that person's skin, you know, to understand how they feel, to understand how things make them react and think. When I'm in a group therapy setting, I guess my theoretical orientation shifts a little bit, And what I look for is the way that people are interacting with one another and to point that out. And in our society, that's kind of rude, you know. It's rude to say, wow, your tone of voice is you know, kind of intense right now. You know, what's going on? We don't do that in normal cocktail conversation.
Well, my impression is that little girls were raised to say nice girls are never angry, never express anger.
Right.
Is that right?
Oh, that's true.
And how did you overcome that so that you were able to do it in a group therapy session?
I don't think I get angry very often, honestly. Well, sometimes I do, but I really try to express myself in a calm way. Sometimes I do get angry, but I think in group therapy in particular, and individual as well, I try to communicate the message that feelings are information. You know, and if you're angry, that doesn't mean you're a terrible person or cruel or unpleasant. It's a signal that there's something wrong and you're in danger of being hurt or you have been hurt. So it's good to pay attention to that anger. And it's not so much what feelings you have, but it's what you do with them.
I really like that phrase, pay attention to your anger. I thought for a long time that when someone's angry, if I'm angry or someone is angry with me, that someplace there's a hurt going on. And that's the thing to try to listen to. But, of course, anger takes mm-hmm. us off. Mm-hmm. So I like your phrase, and maybe you'll comment and see how close I am with that from your perspective. But we will be right back after a quick break. You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with Dr. Lisa Viator.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Ted Dotz. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating Covenant Heart and Vascular Institute. Since 1965, Covenant has brought together cardiac physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. More information is available on cardiac care at 866-4-COVENANT. Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Ted Dotz.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ted Dotz with our guest today, Dr. Lisa Viator, who is a psychologist, professional counselor, associate director of the Student Counseling Center at Texas Tech University. And Lisa, I should like to pursue a little bit more, if we could, confrontation. Mm-hmm. For example, in your own life, having people angry with you, it's one thing to examine when we're angry ourselves and to reflect on it. How is it when you have people angry with you? Maybe the difference between when you were young and now as a professional. How do you handle anger directed at you?
I guess the short answer is it depends. It depends on who it is and why it is. When people very close to me are angry, I feel awful. I feel a push or an urge, you know, for resolution. And sometimes that doesn't really serve me very well because I don't honor my own, you know, experience of what happened. I just want to focus on the other person and what do I need to do to make it better rather than, you know, my own perspective. Sometimes I focus too much on my own perspective if I'm angry too, you know, and that kind of blocks a productive conversation. I guess there needs to be kind of a balance. So when people close to me and my immediate family, you know, are angry with me, I probably struggle with that the most. Now, if a client is angry with me, somehow that's different. I don't take that as personally. I view it as kind of a natural part of the healing process. Like, let's say someone grew up in a situation where it was not okay to express anger, and then they are angry with me and they tell me that. That's like a victory. So in some ways, I view that differently. I think in the family situation, that's more of a challenge for me.
You mentioned challenge, but the image I get is with people that we love and love us, if they get angry with us, it throws us off balance.
Exactly.
So we're not there, the calm, solid, have all the answer person.
Yes.
Instead, we're all this confused mass of jello.
Yes.
But I think that's a good thing if we just had the other and we're never confused. But I guess as a professional, then you need to bring in the solid, responsive answers.
Yeah, I'd say that that's pretty accurate. And again, sometimes it's therapeutic to not have all the answers as well.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So it could work in the professional setting as well to
You're
admit
right.
a certain confusion or being thrown off balance.
Yes.
Another word you used that struck me was the word honor. You said something about honoring your own feelings or identity. Often working with people, I have folks who are anxious about their parents, and maybe a parent is making a huge demand on them because mm-hmm. of dementia or aging. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, look, honor your parents from the Bible means to give appropriate weight to. So the decision is, what's appropriate when you come to honor? It isn't just some kind of leading with a massive idea, I should do everything that's wanted. Do you have comments on that, or comments about when you say honor yourself, or mm-hmm. to use the word honor?
Yeah, I like what you said about, you know, balance and appropriate weight and things like that. If you have a situation where someone's caring for an elderly parent who needs a whole lot, if you as the sandwich generation person is totally depleted, you're not going to be much good to your parents, your children, or yourself. Creative solutions, I think, need to be found in terms of how much and how intensely can I give while also taking care of myself. And again, there's that paying attention and honoring what you need, knowing when you're reaching the point where, I'm getting pretty exhausted here. You know, what do I need to do to take care of myself?
When you're working with students, how do you manage to help them learn to pay attention to themselves, to watch what's going on, which I think is extremely important. In my experience now as I age, I think back of the people I've seen, and men have a very hard time. Like if I will say, tell me how you're feeling in a visit with someone, often men will have a very difficult time telling me that.
I'd say that's accurate. I think in our culture, men are raised to be strong and not very emotionally expressive and to take care of others. And I think that's a real burden for them to carry sometimes, because they do have feelings and things do affect them, but they push that away, often to a closet that they close the door on. It's like every time something happens that's upsetting, it's like they open that closet door and they throw that in there. And then, you know, I ask them, well, what happens when that closet gets so full it can't contain it anymore? They have, you know, a lot of difficulty functioning. They might get depressed. They might have trouble getting out of bed in the morning. They just kind of are worn out.
Well, I like that image of packing things away rather than, I think, to think about them or express them or to share them. I've long thought that's usually a issue that comes up with sexuality. If people have not dealt with their sexual feelings, pretty soon they'll come out in a distorted way, often middle age or later. As a counselor working, say, especially with young men at the university and young men who have thrown things back in that closet, how does a counselor go about helping working with that?
I think it just takes some persistence, you know, in terms of sitting with that person and helping them develop an emotional vocabulary and helping them identify in their bodies, you know, where they feel things, and learning to kind of match that sensation with those words. And then from there, trying to figure out what they want and need, and how do you express that in an assertive manner.
Lisa, what a great answer. St. Augustine, the great saint, lived 4th century, would argue that people have to learn to think with their body, that is to pay attention to what the body is saying. But I think young men are often taught to ignore that. If you have a pain, just go through it.
Right, be tough.
Yeah, don't listen to what your body tells you. What's been an influence? What influenced you to become a psychologist?
You know, it's kind of odd. I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, you know, when I was a senior in high school. You know, I took the psychology high school level course, and I just knew, okay, this is it. This is who I am. And I never strayed from that. I was a psychology major in undergrad. I knew I wanted to be a therapist, and I went straight through. So I knew that that's what I'm good at. And speaking of faith, you know, I really had a sense that that's what God wanted me to do.
Thank you for that. I think the power of a teacher is something. You said you took a course.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a noble thing. And I imagine teachers having an ability to offer an influence. thank you for being with us today. Your refreshing openness and the wide experience is immensely helpful. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Ted Dotts, and you've been listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with Dr. Lisa Viator.
You've been listening to Faith Matters with your host, Ted Dotts. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, working to improve health and quality of life in our communities. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1, a service of Texas Tech Public Radio.